I'm Emily Renneberg, and this is Even Strength. Welcome back to the podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Happy New Year. We have a great episode lined up for you today. We're here to continue the conversation of inclusion and the world of sports right into 2021. So thanks for tuning in. So let's get right into it. Sport is considered to be one of the last remaining North American institutions that separates the sexes, with men and women being segregated from the grassroots levels all the way up to elite sports. It continues to be the primary principle of sport organization, followed by age grouping. The sports community at every level of competition is incredibly divided on whether or not this idea of keeping the sexes apart makes any sense for the sport, the development of athletes, and higher levels of competition. Some people suggest creating a sports model similar to the Paralympics, where athletes are grouped by the movement their bodies can perform. Some suggest having everyone compete together and just do away with sex segregation. And some people are astounded to even think about restructuring sport and worry how it will impact the athletes. There's a lot of consideration in this topic, and there's a lot of different feelings and science and facts that go into this. It's complicated to tackle, but luckily for us, we're able to welcome an academic perspective onto the podcast today.
Hi, my name is William, and I'm an associate professor in the Faculty of Kinesiology at the University of Calgary. I research and teach in the area of sociocultural aspects of sport, physical activity, and the body. My longest affiliation with sport is in figure skating. I've been involved in that sport in a number of different ways for most of my life.
Dr. Bridell has taught at Queen's, the University of Alberta, Miami University of Ohio, and the University of Calgary. Like he mentioned, much of his life has been involved with figure skating, and it helped bring him to academia.
So I grew up very active in sports. I was a competitive figure skater growing up, and I was one of the only boys, and often the only boy in the town that I lived in Ontario, that figure skated. And that was certainly not easy back in the 1970s and 80s. And we, you know, through research, know that there still is the boys who participate in figure skating and other sports that are considered so-called girls' sports, do run into issues of being bullied and things like that. Of course, when I was experiencing that as an athlete, I didn't realize that that's what I would end up doing with my life. I actually went to work at the National Sport Organization, Skate Canada, following my undergraduate degree. But through some of my experiences as an athlete, through some of my experiences as a sport leader, I decided that academia was really more the trajectory for me so that I could research and teach more critical perspectives about sport with, I would say, a general goal of trying to make sport more inclusive for everybody.
Sport inclusivity is a significant consideration from a grassroots level all the way up to a competitive level, and it's oftentimes overlooked because of the traditional nature of sport organization that we talked about earlier.
For me, sport is however people really want to define it or construct it in their own lives. So, you know, we can certainly think about sport in terms of formal, organized, institutionalized sport that are, you know, regulated through rules at a national level, provincial level, or international level. We can think about informal sport, where people get together and participate in a sort of non-competitive physical activity. In large part, I would say, due to the way that modern sport sort of has been produced, we tend to think of sport in very Eurocentric terms in Canada, but certainly sport and physical activity has an incredibly long history in the country through Indigenous sport, games, and physical activity.
In our 9th episode of this podcast, we had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Janice Forsyth about colonialism and its values that have shaped what most Canadians deem organized sport today. If you'd like to learn more about Indigenous sport from her, find that episode on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or visit us on Instagram. So I asked Dr. Bridell about his thoughts on sport segregation and how he sees the future of sport.
This is honestly a question that I go back and forth on a lot. And I think it's the best answer that I've come up with to this point in time. And there are people who are going to agree with me, and there are people who are going to disagree with me, of course. I think we tend to organize sport at all levels based on what happens at the most elite levels of a sport. And I don't think that that has to be the case. So I think there's opportunity to think differently about grassroots and community sport that doesn't segregate boys and girls so early on. I also think that there's opportunity to rethink the rules of sport, which are often used as a way to explain why sport continues to need to be segregated. But not every sport needs to be regulated in the same way. So something like curling doesn't need to have the same rules as football or rugby, for example. So often the argument made is that, men are by and large, quote unquote, naturally stronger than women. And, I think it's quite well documented that at an elite level, there's about a 10 to 12% performance difference in most sports between men and women. But that's not true at all at the lower levels, like grassroots level, at developmental level. What I think happens is that girls and women at those levels are often, or girls and young women are coached differently based on traditional ways of thinking about women's bodies and girls' bodies as being somehow more frail than boys and men's. Technically, only national sport federations who are supporting athletes who are competing at an international level and under the rules of the international federation need to follow International Olympic Committee rules. So other than that, in Canadian sport, it really is fair game. And there are some sport organizations who are starting to, quote unquote, think outside the box in that regard and to think differently about the way that sport can be implemented and delivered.
Dr. Ian Ritchie of Brock University says, quote, "There's no any one way that sport has to be done. Sport as an institution was created through gender lines and assumption about gender." There is some interesting research that's been conducted with mixed martial art and combat sport that recognizes that when men and women compete and practice with each other, there is a kind of, quote, bias undoing, in which participants are encouraged to identify and behave in ways which challenge sexist understandings of performance differences in sport.
Sport, many sports sociologists make this argument that sport is one of the last social institutions that remain so highly segregated based on ideas of binary sex and gender. We know, I'm certainly not an expert in developmental psychology of children, but we know that, children have a pretty good sense of gender and gender identity, by the time they're 3, 4, 5, 6 years of age. And so if they are put into sport by their parents or their guardians, we certainly start to see how ideas about gender are then reinforced, or traditional ideas about gender are reinforced. And it's through things like lack of female coaches, or if there is a woman who's involved in soccer, for example, oftentimes they take on the role of sort of the team manager, and a man will take on the role of coach. And there's a lot of research that backs this up. And, that's a largely reflective of traditional gender ideology, and certainly not reflective of a lack of women who are interested in coaching roles or taking on more leadership roles in sport. The idea of gender, or traditional ideas about gender, certainly reinforced through the media as well. And so there's a ton of research that exists that demonstrates that in the North American context, women's sports only receives about 4% of total media coverage. And there's a quite famous quote by a child right activist. The quote is, "You can't be what you can't see." And so if you're not seeing women in coaching roles, you're not seeing women in leadership roles, you're not seeing women's sport on television, then certain ideas are reinforced for girls and women, but also for boys and men. It sort of naturalizes, and I'm using quotes, air quotes here, naturalizes this notion that sport is a space for boys and men that girls and women have to fight to be a part of. Then it also, with sport being so segregated, also makes it very complicated for individuals who don't identify in binary ways. So gender non-conforming folks, gender non-binary, gender queer folks.
Inclusivity in sport goes well beyond the sexes too. With sport being so intensely gendered and separated into the binary male-female, this can create an intensely exclusive environment. Many folks struggle to find a way to participate, belong, and find the community and joy that sport brings to countless individuals. Trans people, non-binary individuals, and people outside of the gender binary are some examples of those who are often excluded from sport, not considered in the development or structuring of athletics, or heavily debated in terms of how they can be allowed to participate.
Sort of rules and regulations of sport are really problematic for trans and for gender nonconforming folks. But it's also about a lack of education within the sports system, I would say, about the experiences of trans and gender nonconforming folks and why there should be a space made for them within organized informal sport, recreational programming, physical activity opportunities, so on and so forth. You know, there are many trans individuals who do identify sort of in the binary, so trans women, trans men. And so while policy is certainly important, education is equally as important, if not more so, because policy is on paper a great step, but we know that through documented experiences that it doesn't play out this way in positive ways. And there are also problematic trans inclusion policies still within the Canadian sports system. For gender nonconforming folks, they're almost never included in any kind of policy because we are so ingrained in this idea that sport does have to be segregated into boys and girls and men and women. And so there's a ton of thinking that has to happen around traditional ideas about the way that sport is organized so that we can make it more open and inclusive to gender nonconforming folks or gender non-binary or genderqueer folks, along with, of course, still really important conversations about trans inclusion.
Dr. Bridell started a project in 2017 for Skate Canada with this in mind.
One of the main outcomes, I would say, was the creation of the trans inclusion policy, which has been in place since 2018 for the organization. We also had a tremendous team of undergrad students working with me a few summers ago, which I'm really grateful for. And we did a full policy and rule and regulation review, looking through all of the documents that sort of govern the sport at an operational level and a technical level to make recommendations to how language could be more inclusive in those rules. So as one step, it's replacing things like he and she with they. It's about replacing reference to gender to roles. So for example, instead of saying males or females, specify coach, specify official, if that's who you're talking about. So this has impact beyond LGBTQI2S plus inclusion, but it certainly is all wrapped up in the same conversation. Then we also made some recommendations about rules that they could potentially change at the recreational and development level to make sport more inclusive for gender nonconforming folks. So costume rules, for example, were changed so that it didn't stipulate any longer that boys and men had to wear pants and girls and women had to wear skirts or dresses. There were some changes made to the sort of early levels in the recreational stream, what's called Star Skate, so that there's no longer sort of like Star 1 boys and Star 2 girls. It's just Star 1. There were some changes to partnership rules that were recommended. So instead of stipulating that it had to be in the recreational stream, that it had to be one male and one female, it's just two skaters. Some of the other recommendations we're working on is educational resources that are available on the organization's website. We've posted some general ones from the beginning of the project. So just introducing ideas like the difference between sex and gender is a social construction, and what's gender identity, what's gender expression, what does LGBTQI2S plus stand for, things like that. But we developed some more specific materials. For example, we created a document that was 8 steps to make your skating club more inclusive or to make skating more inclusive. And so some of the recommendations in that were to just simply display like a rainbow flag somewhere in the club or even on your person. So like on a coffee mug. As a professor, I carry a coffee mug with a rainbow flag so people know that I'm somebody who is safe to come and speak to. So things, recommendations that were sort of policy related, rules and regulation related, educational, but also sort of proactive in trying to create a space that would make queer folks feel welcome.
Dr. Bridell has been involved with the figure skating community for many years, and much of his work today is with Skate Canada. His perspective also comes from being a gay man and participating in a sport that is known for its very traditional views on sexuality and gender expression.
I started skating in a smallish town in Ontario when I was 4, so that would have been around like 1976. And I fell in love with skating immediately. And so this idea of music and movement just really spoke to me in some way. And so I ended up pursuing that. It was difficult, for sure. I was bullied quite relentlessly at school and even at the rink. Hockey players who were waiting to go onto the ice after the skaters were practicing. But I loved it. And so I kept going. And so in a weird way, what the sport that caused me kind of a lot of torment in my life also was a space where I could escape all of this as well. And so there's this sort of, you know, paradox, I suppose. Would the bullying have stopped if I stopped skating? Potentially. Did I want to stop skating? No. But I also, I came out of the closet as a gay man starting when I was about 17 years of age. And in skating at the time, there was a tremendous amount of silence around sexuality. And in fact, it was something that was actively, officials in the sport and the media sort of actively tried to deny that there was gay men in figure skating. And this is, you know, quite well documented and researched by Dr. Mary Louise Adams at Queen's University, who's done some, you know, really, really important work on gender norms and skating in Canada. And so I lived through that. I lived through this silence. And so even when I came out, it was a little bit like, you know, the American military's old policy, don't ask, don't tell. You know, people knew, but nobody talked about it. That was, you know, it was really difficult. I felt like after I did come out to some coaches and people who I trained with, although certainly people I trained with were very supportive, but in terms of the coaches, I would say that my experience in skating changed after that. And there was some expectation of, you know, quote unquote, more masculine kinds of performances to ensure that, you know, I would be successful without, you know, any concern about my sexuality. I don't think I realized that at the time, of course. You know, I loved the sport. I loved competing. I loved who I trained with. Looking back through a critical lens now and with the knowledge that I've been able to acquire, I've been able to sort of unpack my experiences and make sense of them more within these larger ideas about gender and their intersections with sexuality. You know, there was also a lot of silence around HIV and AIDS, and there was certainly a significant impact of AIDS on Canadian skating and skating elsewhere in the world that hasn't really been discussed very openly. And a lot of it was out of concern of parents, and I would say fathers in particular, not wanting to register their sons. Have things shifted? Sure. But there still is a lot of work to be done, in particular around the involvement of lesbian and queer women in the sport. It's such a hyper-feminized, people don't think about their participation in a sport like skating, but they are present, and they need to have a voice, and they need to be considered and represented. I say this to my students all the time, and they probably are so sick of hearing it, but we like to think black and white, but social life and experiences of social life are gray. And it's messy and it's complex, and we try to oversimplify it. It just doesn't reflect the human experience.
Skate Canada has embraced many of the action items and recommendations that Dr. Bridell has provided to the organization. But he still sees work that needs to be done to shape sport inclusivity in figure skating and well beyond into every other sport.
I think within skating, I mean, I have to give kudos to Skate Canada for sure. I mean, it was probably not easy to, you know, it's not easy to admit that, you know, a sport that you've been involved in for all your life as an athlete, as a coach, as an official, combination of those things, you know, has this sort of homophobic history and, you know, a silence around sexuality. And that's been really harmful to a lot of people. And so Skate Canada's willingness to be a part of this project and sort of to open up their rule book, so to speak, and their policies to have us critique them and offer them some suggestion, and then to see them act on some of the suggestions has been really powerful. And I think they deserve, as an organization, a ton of credit around the work they've done on LGBTQI2S+ inclusion. I think that other sports in general, there still is a ton of work to get done. I mean, there's still work in skating to get done for sure, but I'm proud of the work that the organization has done to this point. You know, there's the National Hockey League has their Hockey is for Everybody program, and a ton of MLB teams do Pride Nights, and, you know, NBA, same thing. You know, to me, that's it's a little bit of performative activism, and there's not necessarily a strong enough, I would say, commitment to education. So I'll give you an example. So Kevin Pillar, maybe about 3 years ago, was playing for the Toronto Blue Jays. And this was a team who was connected to the You Can Play organization. And Kevin Pillar, during a game, used a homophobic slur against an opponent. His first apology wasn't really an apology. It was sort of an explanation. And then the Blue Jay organization issued sort of an apology, and they fined him. And my problem with that is that if a homophobic slur is your go-to in a moment of anger, that's not just about the individual, that's also about the culture. Yeah, I liken it sort of to, you know, zero tolerance policies in relation to bullying. By that point, you know, the damage has already been done to the person who is the victim of the bullying behavior, as well as the person who has initiated that bullying behavior. And so while I think there have to be ramifications, of course, you know, these policies can't exist without really meaningful and multidimensional educational programs.
Something that I believe is an important part of what this podcast is about and what it provides to people is accessibility to stories that wouldn't necessarily be featured in mainstream media. I also believe that it's a place where we can learn together and take some of the learnings and help improve the world around us. Now, obviously we aren't going to be able to make all the Earth's problems go away, but each of us has more influence and more capabilities to create change than we allow ourselves to believe. You may think, hey, well, I'm just a treasurer on my kid's team, or I'm just a player in a local league, or anything else that could follow I'm just. But you're not just. You're an important piece of an important community, and there are things that you can incorporate into your team, your association, your circles, that will help nurture sports inclusivity for everyone.
Amplifying the voices of those individuals in your organization who are already there, who are willing to share experiences, share their time, share their knowledge, need to be listened to and need to be heard. I think it's also then about taking meaningful action. So not just about giving people the opportunity to speak, but then also following through. I think too often we have these really great conversations about diversification and inclusion, and they become just that. Conversations. There needs to be action that follows from the listening, but the listening should come first. Sport can be a really wonderful thing. What I feel is that sport is not living up to its full potential. I will never argue against the idea that sport has the possibility of developing better physical and mental health and better social health and, you know, better emotional wellness. But it doesn't do that for everybody because of some of the barriers that we've talked about today. And there are, of course, many, many others. And so we need to continue to chip away at or even radically rethink the structure of sport so that it can live up to its full potential, so that everybody, regardless of their gender identity expression, regardless of their sexuality, regardless of their race, ethnicity, ability, social class, has the opportunity to benefit from sport in the same way that I would say a rather small percentage of our population does right now.
As always, a massive thank you to Dr. Bridell for lending his time and expertise to us today. I always learn so much putting these episodes together, and I hope you do too. This is the 11th episode of Even Strength, so if you need to catch up, again, please look us up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or visit us on Instagram or Twitter at Even Strength Pod, and you'll be able to find all our other episodes. Thank you again for tuning in. Here's to a happy 2021. Take care.